Welcome to Excess Returns, where we focus on what works over the long term in the markets. Join us as we talk about the strategies and tactics that can help you become a better long-term investor.
Justin Carbonell and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.
In this episode of Excess Returns, Jack interviews Jeff Mollenkamp, a portfolio manager at Mollenkamp & Company. They discuss Jeff's views on inflation, the likelihood of a recession, and the possibility of another financial crisis. Jeff shares his investment process, which focuses on finding good companies with strong growth, profitability, and financial strength. He also discusses the importance of understanding management incentives and how he incorporates macroeconomic factors into his investment decisions. As always, thank you for listening. Please enjoy this episode with Jeff Mollenkamp of Mollenkamp & Company.
Jeff, thank you for coming back on.
Thanks for having me back, Jack. Looking forward to the discussion today.
We're going to cover a lot of ground today. We're going to talk about the markets. We're going to talk about your investment strategy. We're going to talk about where you're seeing opportunities. But before I do that, I wanted to start with inflation, because that's probably something that's at the top of everybody's mind right now. And it's something you've covered in your quarterly letters. And I was reading them in preparation for this. And in your January 2023 letter, you laid out three core questions, and then you revisited them in January 2024. So I want to start by asking you those three core questions and how you're thinking about them right now. And the first question was, will inflation remain high? If so, how high will it be? So how are you thinking about that now, as in contrast to how you were thinking about that, you know, in January 2023?
So a year ago, we thought inflation would probably stay in the 3-4% range. And last year, we saw it, you know, get down to the low threes, right? I think it bottomed in June at about 3.1%. It ticked up a little bit since then. So currently, and we look at CPI, we don't get too fancy. We don't split PCE, CPI. We don't manipulate it six ways to Sunday. We don't find that terribly useful. So right now we're at a 3% inflation, right? And the Fed has paused in its tightening. And we think that kind of indicates that they're willing to tolerate 3-4% inflation, right? So that's a useful piece of information for us. And then we're looking at the other things going on. You know, what does government spending look like? We think that is a bearing on inflation. And then what is kind of growth around the world look like? What is, you know, the expansion of the money supply look like? Those sorts of things. Ball all that up, I think you're still going to be in a 3-4% inflation environment for the next year. And the risks are probably to the upside, not the downside.
You know, to your point about splitting inflation three ways to Sunday, you know, that's something investors have to be so careful about, because no matter what your opinion is on inflation, you can take those numbers and you can make them back up your opinion. You know, you can do right. The trimmed mean of this, or, you know, exclude this and that. And like, it's so, no matter what it is, whether you think it's going to be crazy high, or you think it's going to be crazy low, it's something to be very careful about, because you can chop those numbers up in a million different ways.
So we use just plain CPI. There's a lot of different ways you can slice and dice inflation numbers. Some people like PCE or core PCE. Some people don't trust the numbers at all, thinking that they no longer reflect reality. We haven't found that to be a useful, a good use of our time to dig into that, to try and parse what is exactly going on, because it's not really useful in our decision-making process. We are comfortable being approximately right instead of precisely right. And that's good enough for us. So that's kind of how we think about it.
I'm curious, when you talk to your investors, do they still ask a lot about inflation? Like, have you seen that come down over time as inflation's come down, or is that still a topic you get asked about a lot?
No, they really haven't. That's a great question. And on reflection, it is not top of mind for our investors.
And which, that's probably a sign you've got the right kind of investors. It's probably a sign you've got good long-term investors who are probably not thinking about this day-to-day stuff.
We do. We've got great investors. They're wonderful to work with.
So on the second question, this is an interesting question, because this is something a lot of people have been calling for a very, very long time. You know, the recession is coming, the recession is coming, the recession is coming, and the recession has not come. So your question you had in your letter was, will the United States enter a recession? If so, how bad will it be? So how are you thinking about that right now?
So, you know, I have to admit, I've been in that camp. We've been calling for a recession for a very long time, right? So we were calling for a recession really the end of 21. As the yield curve started to invert, we saw the stock market start to come down. We expected problems in the housing industry. We saw that happen, right? We saw problems in the financial industry about this time last year. And none of that has been enough to put the U.S. into a recession, which is fascinating. And so, you know, about a year, 18 months ago, as things started to diverge in a positive fashion economically from what I thought was going to happen, I started to say, well, what's going on here? Why is that? Why is what we expected not unfolding? And the tentative answer to that question is that government spending and business spending has overwhelmed some of the other things that were going on. So if you look at, for instance, you know, debt to GDP or deficit to GDP as a measure of how much we're spending, it's now at a wartime level. It's at about 6% of GDP. That's the amount we're spending over and above what we're bringing in. And so, you know, we are putting a lot of fiscal stimulus into the economy, even as we withdraw all of that monetary stimulus. And that surprised me. And I think that's at the root of what you're seeing. So, you know, so the next question is, well, could we still get a recession? And I hesitate to say no, because you really can't ignore the inverted yield curve. It's got a really great track record of predicting recessions with a variable time lag, and it's still inverted. And you've also got the problems with commercial real estate out there that have not fully worked themselves through the banking system. And in fact, I would argue are probably in early innings. So there are some potential problems out there that might create a recession. But I'd have to say that the odds are lower than they were a year ago, right? So I can't completely rule it out. I wish it could. I can't. But most of the other, you know, when you start looking at ISMs and you start looking at leading indicators and those sorts of things, they stopped getting worse and they've kind of bottomed out, and a couple of them are starting to get better. You know, ISM manufacturing that just released is starting to tick up a little bit. And then services never went into contractionary territory. So those sorts of things give you some confidence. Things are getting a little better in the economy. So I would have to say remains possible, not terribly likely. And I've put some money to work as a result.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, I was in the same camp as you. Like, I didn't see how we could increase rates as fast as we did and not have some sort of recession. And I mean, like you mentioned, the yield curve inversion is 100% track record historically. Yeah. Now, it's not a huge end. It's not a huge sample size. But it's been, you know, it's been successful in with a lag time of varying lengths in predicting this. So I was in your camp. I was like, I don't see how we get through this without a recession. And maybe we don't. Maybe it's just a lot further out in the future than many of us thought.
And it may be, right? So you still, I mean, typically the recession starts after you cut rates. We haven't cut rates yet. So there's nothing going on that is ruled out by historical precedent. Nonetheless, you're starting to see some things tick up. And there have been, you know, there's some really surprising things happen this time around. If you'd asked me 3 years ago what would happen to the housing market when rates went from, you know, let's call it 30-year mortgages went from 3% to 7%, I just said housing prices will tank. And they haven't. Right? So you had a decline in home sales for all of about 6 months. But then what happened was everybody with an existing home decided they're not selling it because they don't want a 7% mortgage to replace their 3% mortgage. So you took an enormous amount of inventory off the market, and all you're left with is new home sales. And shockingly, demand for new homes and demand for the rest of the homes has maintained the pricing of homes throughout the country. And nobody would have predicted that. So you've got like a second order effect overwhelming what should have been a dominant first quarter effect. Didn't happen that way. So there's some surprising things going on that are just flat out difficult to predict.
Yeah, I was on the same page as you with housing. Like, I missed the supply part of it. I missed the part that nobody's going to put their houses on the market and supply is going to be kept so low. You know, when I thought about it, I was thinking about the demand part of rates going up, and I didn't consider the supply part. But I guess a lot of people didn't, because we've never seen anything like this before.
Never seen anything like it before, which really, you know, to me, we all try our very best to predict the future. And a lot of times that's based on what we saw happen in the past. But it just reminds me to be humble about your prediction.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. Give it your best shot. You know, put yourself out there, but recognize that you might be wrong, and invest that way a little bit too. You know, I think this is going to happen, but I might be wrong. So I can't go all in on this. I have to hedge my bet a little bit in almost everything you do.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, that's a recipe to blow up. Going all in on anything, thinking you're 100% right in the markets. You know, I always think about how many smart people operate in the markets. And I try to think about myself and my intelligence against the collective of all those people. And like, what are the odds I'm going to be right and every one of them is going to be wrong? It's probably not that great. So I always think about that when I size anything I do.
Right. Right. Makes perfect sense.
I'm just curious on the housing thing. Like, do you think, I've been thinking about this a lot. I've been thinking about like when rates do go back down, this is kind of outside of my area of expertise, but I'm trying to think about how that, you know, obviously my first principles framework would be, well, when rates go back down, that's going to make the housing market go up even more. But then I'm like, am I missing the same thing I missed the first time? There's some sort of effect where like supply is going to be unlocked because rates go back down. And maybe it doesn't have the effect we think. I mean, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. It's just something I've been thinking about.
Yeah, I've been thinking. So the way I frame it, the current situation is unsustainable over the longer term, right? So I think a couple of things are happening, and a couple of things are already happening. So the first thing that's happening is home builders are building cheaper homes, right? So they went to building expensive homes, mostly because interest rates were so low and money was so cheap. That's what people wanted to buy. And now that that market has gotten priced out of the market by the higher interest rate, they're going to adjust what they're building. So that's one thing that's going to happen. And as those price points start to come down, you start to see more activity there. The other thing that I think is going to happen is even if rates don't come down, I think you're going to start to free up inventory on the used side simply because some moves are not optional, right? So if I'm, you know, coming up on retirement age and I'm thinking about downsizing, I can defer that decision as long as I want. That is a completely optional decision. And if I, you know, my house is paid off or I'm still at 3% and I don't want that 7% mortgage, I can defer that almost infinitely. No big deal. But if I'm a working guy or girl and I get posted, you know, I'm going to have to move from Pittsburgh to Houston and I've got two kids, I'm not moving into an apartment. I'm going to move into a house and I'm going to sell the house here in Pittsburgh to do that. Right. So there's just going to be now this level of forced moves that probably start to free up the market. You know, you might delay that home sale and purchase for 6 months. You're not delaying it for 2 years. Right. And you're not doing that to your family. So over time, that will start to kind of break the logjam, if you will. And then if rates came down, I think probably incremental improvement on the used side. You know, I think at the margin, some people would say, okay, I'll do that downsize for at 6% where I wouldn't do it at 7%. But unless rates drop dramatically, it won't necessarily be very sudden. So I guess my baseline is sort of a gradual thawing of the used market, if you will, without necessarily a lot of impact on overall housing prices.
So your third question is another one that a lot of people are thinking about right now, which is, will a financial crisis erupt that prompts the Federal Reserve to drop interest rates and perhaps restart quantitative easing? If so, will this cause inflation to run up again? So the first part of that, like some of us thought maybe the Silicon Valley Bank type of thing could have been that financial crisis, but it wasn't. But then there's a lot of other stuff floating around. There's the commercial real estate market. You know, people are talking about the refinancing wall for companies, particularly in the high yield space. Like, do you see anything? So how are you thinking about this question in terms of if another financial crisis might be brewing in the future?
I think there are good reasons why it's possible and good reasons why it's not certain, right? So as interest rates move up, all these debt instruments fell in price. So anybody who uses that as collateral for another loan is in trouble if they have to realize the existing price. And that's exactly what happened to SVB. They needed cash. They had high quality assets. They had treasuries. The problem was when they sold that treasury, they only got 80 cents on the dollar. And so it blew up their capital base because they had to sell them to meet, you know, cash calls from depositors. So if the people who are holding those assets and are forced to sell them at a discounted price because interest rates have come up, then we're going to have a problem. On the other hand, if things work out so that that happens over a decade instead of in a year, we will not have a systemic problem. So it all really comes down to how fast do we work the new pricing into the existing financial structure. If it's very rapid, it will be a problem. And that will force, in my opinion, the central bank to react to it like it did with SVB. They will have to come in and do something to either bolster the price of that debt or to guarantee it or something else, right? They were pretty creative with how they did it a year ago. I expect they will be creative again if they have to. But you can't just let the banking system collapse because suddenly we've marked to market all the assets that really, if they were marked to market, would make it insolvent. So you've got to have this extend and pretend so that you can realize the losses over time. Or frankly, just, a 10-year treasury at 80 cents on the dollar today, if I go 9 years, it's going to be trading at par. No loss. As long as I don't have to sell it today, I'm good. So coin toss could go either way. But yeah, you're not going to be able to say, oh no, we're good for a decade until you work through all the repricing of CRE, until you rolled over all these loans from 4 or 5 years ago that were made at 2% and 3% into now 4% and 5% loans. Until you do that, you can't say dodge that bullet because you're still dodging the bullet. We're in the middle of dodging the bullet. So yeah, possible.
So the last part of your question could kind of apply to a couple different scenarios. One is like a financial crisis where the Fed has to cut rates dramatically. The other could be what looks like it's playing out right now, which is the Fed is going to start what they hope will be a slow process to bring rates back to normal. But the question in both cases is, will this spur inflation? And is inflation entrenched enough that they're going to, we're going to cause problems by being too soon on these rate cuts? So how do you think about that?
I lean towards inflation is going to be here until we actively fight it. It's interesting your comment. The Fed wants to bring rates back to normal. So the first question is, what is normal? Right. And historically, normal is that the federal funds rate is on or about the rate of inflation. And the long treasury is something like 2 or 3% above it. Right. That's normal. So if you apply that to today's 3% inflation, we'll just use 3%. Okay, then the federal funds rate ought to be on the order of 3%. And the 30-year ought to be something like 6. So that kind of forms the foundation of what I expect. So if, in fact, inflation is relatively stable here at 3 to 4%, then I ought to see the Fed bring short-term rates down, but I still should see the long rate go up. And the last time the long bond went above 5%, things started to get really exciting in the bond market, right? About October of last year, we popped over 5%. You got a lot of volatility in the bond market. And suddenly Janet Yellen said, we're not going to borrow all the new money long term. We're going to borrow it much shorter term. And what she didn't say was why. But my guess is it's because we can't afford to borrow 5%. And so we're going to go borrow here shorter term with something less. 2 year gets you 4.25 or whatever, right? So the bond market wasn't willing to support that long rate. So normalization of the yield curve in terms of lower short-term rates and higher long-term rates is going to be very interesting to watch. It's also going to be interesting to see what happens to the federal budget as they continue to roll over all this very cheap debt into much more expensive debt. So when you talk about, the risk of borrowers having to roll debt, to me, the key entity to watch is the most indebted entity on the planet, which would be our federal government. And how do they deal with that? Do they in fact accept 5% returns or 5%, interest on their debt? Or do they start looking to the Fed to do something like yield curve control, which there's plenty of historical precedent to do, both in the United States and internationally. So this is going to be really interesting. And to me, one of the risks out there is to that long-term bond holder, which is frankly why I don't want to be a long bond holder. I'm happy to be on the short end. I have no interest in going on the long end. I see too many risks and not enough rewards for me to want to play out there.
Yeah, I think it's interesting how you looked at normal in both ways, not just from the perspective of the Fed funds rate, but also in perspective of like longer-term rates, the 10-year, because yeah, you're right. I mean, normal might be 200 basis points less on the short rate, but even with a normal yield curve, that the long rate won't come down at all with that. Right. Or might even go up a little bit. So for people hoping their mortgages and stuff are going to come down, you know, this may not play out exactly, you know, these Fed rate cuts may not play out exactly as they'd hoped it would.
And I think the market is starting to not necessarily bet that way, but to start to realize that that might be possible. But we'll see. Really, we will see. There's a lot of other things going on, you know, in the treasury markets that I think have a bearing on this from the kind of macro perspective, right? So if you look at what other central banks have been buying, they have been not net buyers of treasuries now for 3, 4, 5 years, and what they're buying on net is gold. And you got to say, why is that? You know, why are the central banks looking to gold now as a reserve asset instead of treasuries? And then you look at what happened when Russia invaded Ukraine and we froze all their treasury assets. So any foreign entity that thinks they might be on the wrong side of the U.S. is probably not going to hold their reserves in treasuries because they're now at risk. Whereas, you know, a decade ago, well, of course, my treasuries would be fine, right? So there's that. And then, of course, you've got Saudi Arabia selling oil in other currencies besides dollars. So the whole petrodollar circulation of, you know, somebody, you know, gets dollars, buys oil, Saudi Arabia has excess dollars, they put them, buy treasuries with them. That whole cycle is now less big than it was, right? So you got some things going on, you know, mechanisms that had been in place for 40 or 50 years are now unraveling at the edges. Things are shifting at the edges. And you say, what's that going to mean? What's that going to mean to the dollar? What's that going to mean to treasuries? What's that going to mean to yields? And as it has an impact on yields, it starts impacting, you know, the domestic economy and the investing world. So I don't really, you know, assert that I'm a macro investor. I think that in general, you need to pay a little bit of attention. Usually macro doesn't matter, but once in a while it does. And so you need to pay enough attention to at least be alert to changes that might matter. And I think there are some changes going on in the global scheme of things that might matter to the domestic scheme of things.
Yeah,
you heard about that about 2 years ago. I probably need to update that because the things I saw 2 years ago have not reversed. They've got to continue to grow and expand. So the likelihood of them becoming impactful is greater than it was 2 years ago, not less, in my opinion.
Yeah, you touched on what I wanted to ask next, because we see kind of different managers on the show. You know, we see some managers who say, listen, we're in a different macro environment with inflation here. I have to at least pay attention to the macro environment and the way I construct a portfolio. And then we'll get the bottom up people who will say, like, I can't predict any of this. I don't care. Like, I'm just going to pick stocks and I'm going to move on with my life. Like, it seems like you do pay attention to it to some degree when you think about like picking stocks for your portfolio.
Well, the piece that we have paid attention to really since Ron stood up the organization has been inflation. So Ron got into the business in the late 60s, and his formative years were all in the inflationary 70s, right? And so what he observed then and the model he put together and the techniques he put together, you know, really starts with, are we in an inflationary environment or are we in a deflationary environment? You've got to understand that. You don't necessarily have to predict it because it doesn't change very fast. But you do have to recognize where you are. And so when we got the inflation here in, you know, 21, 22, we went through that again and we concluded we are more likely in an inflationary environment going forward than we are in the pre-existing deflationary environment. And that shifts everything, right? So, you know, commodities, oil being a primary one, have not really done all that well the last 10, 20 years. But if you look at the 70s, it's about the only thing that did well during the decade, right? So, you know, we're 20% energy right now. We have been for 3 years. That was a great, great thing for us in 22. Didn't help us too much in 23. We'll see how it is going forward. But that's a result of our conclusion that we're in an inflationary environment, right? And that's to help protect us if we're right. If we're wrong, it probably won't hurt us too much. But if we're right, it's going to do us a lot of good. And I think, so you've got the inflation deflation thing, but then you've also got this, you know, kind of global monetary machine that is shifting gears, changing up, however you want to frame it. But the dollar as the universal currency, I think, is not going to be true in a decade like it was a decade ago. I'm not saying the dollar won't be a trade currency. It will be. There will be others. It won't just be the dollar. And the U.S. Treasury bond as a reserve asset will not be the only reserve asset. And so let me caveat that. We think it's likely, not certain, likely that these changes are happening. And if that occurs, then you say, well, who benefits? And so far, we've arrived at gold will probably benefit. And so we've made some investments to the order of about 6 or 7% in the portfolio that are long cold, essentially. And we'll continue to think about that as things unfold. Okay, is that future that we kind of have in our mind more likely today or less likely relative to where it was 6 months ago, relative to where it was a year ago? So far, things seem to be marching in that direction. More currencies are being used in international trade. Fewer central banks are interested in buying treasuries. So we think the pressure on long yields is going to be up in addition to what's going on with inflation, right? And that's informing the bets we're placing, the investments we're making. I don't want to be on the wrong side of that shift. I don't necessarily need to anticipate it too much, but I don't want to be on the wrong side of it either. So now I would say we are a little bit of a mix. We do like to focus on companies. Now, we have historically really focused a lot on the economic cycle in the U.S. because that was a very definitive sort of a thing. It was really controlled by the Fed. It was fairly easy to predict. That's less true now than it was 20 years ago, at least according to my dad, who's been investing in both environments, and that's what he tells me. So I don't think you have to be all one or the other. If you don't want to be, you can be. I think you can probably make money either way if you're good at it, if you've got the right information and the right tools to understand the information, the data you're getting. And we sort of straddle a little bit both. If we can identify a macro trend, we're happy to ride that sucker. And that's what we're doing a little bit right now. So we think we've got inflation. We're heavy energy. That's the purpose of that. We think we're going to see a greater role for gold in international finance in the future than we have in the recent past. And we're happy to play that a little bit too. And we'll see how those work out.
To your point on your dad, I mean, I think that's probably been a great resource for you. And it's something that I wish I had. Like, you know, Justin and I manage money for our clients and we're in our 40s. And so we can go look at the 70s and look at the data and look at all that. But it's a completely different thing than having lived it. Like, I know when I talk to like investors that are younger than me that didn't live through 2008, they'll look at 2008 and see like this down move in the chart and everything came back and everything was great. And, you know, I lived through that and that thing was brutal. Like living through that is completely different than looking at it and looking at the data after the fact. And I assume the same is probably true of the 70s. It's probably great for you to have somebody who actually managed money, who was actually sitting there and understanding what happened at that time.
It is, right? So Ron's formative experience was the inflation of the 70s. My formative experience, I joined the firm in 2008, October 2008. So the first 6 months I was here was during the worst of the 08-09 crash. And that was formative for me, right? Everything I learned is viewed through the lens of that time frame, for better or worse. And so I think you're right. I think it does, you know, what you first experience when you start investing shapes your view going forward. So Ron is attuned to inflation. And when inflation wasn't a problem, that really didn't help us much, right? Not a competitive advantage. Now that inflation is back, well, it sure helped us in 22 a ton, right? We were up when the market was down. That was a pretty good relative performance year for us. We're pretty happy with that. And I think it's going to help us going forward, right? Because if you think about, you know, what's happening, cost of capital was very low and capital was readily available. And the types of companies and the types of strategies for a company that work in that environment do not work when capital is expensive or hard to come by, right? So Silicon Valley, that is all about gaining market share and worrying about profitability later, right? Capital is so cheap, we'll deploy all this capital. We want to dominate this market, whatever it is, whatever software package we've got. We want to dominate it. We'll pay people to come to our website and we'll monetize it later. That does not work in an environment where capital is hard to come by and much more expensive. What works in that second environment is we're going to bootstrap ourselves. We're going to start small. We're going to become profitable. And we're going to bootstrap growth off our existing profits because external capital is not available, not at a price we can afford. And so we're going to have to change how we do things, right? So everybody that thinks normal is capital falls out of the sky and you can spend willy-nilly as long as you can paint a reasonable picture 10 years in the future about how you're going to turn that into ridiculous amounts of money. Anybody who grew up like that is going to struggle when they've got to pinch pennies and become profitable early because getting that external capital is just so much more difficult than it used to be. And I think that's what we're shifting from into. And so the kinds of things that work here are going to struggle here. And the kinds of things, you know, we always like profitable companies. That didn't matter for a decade. What investors wanted to see was revenue growth, not profitability. We were out of fashion. That was painful. The world is kind of, in my opinion, moving back our way. The kinds of analysis, the kind of things we always like are going to be more effective because they don't rely on external capital and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like my formative experience, like when I came out of college, my first job was with an internet startup in like the late 90s. And what you were talking about is basically what we went through, which is like the venture capitalists that were investing in us were like, we don't care about profits. We don't care about revenue. We care about eyeballs. And so like we ran the business that way. And like it took me a while to get out of that mentality. Like when you saw that huge shift in 2000, you know, if you've come up and that's the way you've grown up in the business, it's a change to say, here's a new environment. I've got to adjust this new environment. And there's probably a lot of people going through that right now who are used to 0% interest rates. And now they're going to have to adjust in terms of the way they operate.
Yeah. You know, I just got done reading the book on Elon Musk and his description of what happened to Twitter when Elon Musk took it over is exactly that. You know, you went from money is no object. We just subsidize all this stuff and all these extra bodies and all this other stuff to, we're very concerned about costs and we're laying off 2/3 of our people. What a sea change for that company. And I suspect at various times that's going to hit different companies in specifically Silicon Valley startups. Right now, a lot of industries weren't enamored of the throw capital at it, get growth going and monetize later. But that's been the Silicon Valley model now. Twice, first into the first tech bubble, and then the second time here that I think is just ending. That's not really new. I'm reminded, you know, when they built the Transcontinental Railroad, the Union Pacific, I forget the one that, on the East Coast, but the U.S. did it differently. The U.S. had very much that Silicon Valley model. We'll just throw a bunch of capital at it. We'll build it all in one go, and then we'll monetize it later. And the track was crappy, and both of the halves of it went bankrupt, and then, you know, it took 20 years for either side of that to be profitable after they built the railroad. Well, the Canadian Pacific did it differently. They built it one town at a time. So they built it from this town to that town and got that section working and profitable, and then that funded the next 20, 30, 40, 50 miles of track. And so they kind of bootstrapped their growth across the continent. So they were profitable the whole time. Now, it took them longer to get the track all the way across the continent, absolutely true, but they were profitable really from very early on instead of having to go through two bankruptcies and et cetera. So that difference in how you build is not unique to the last 20 years. It's been around a long time. And, you know, to me, the difference is what's the cost of capital. What works when it's cheap does not work when it's expensive. And that's what we're going through now is a shift. And I don't want to be on the wrong side.
So shifting back to your investing process, you have some great criteria on your website in terms of the major things you look for in companies. And the first one was interesting to me in that, like in the quant space where I operate, and I know you don't operate the quant space, but we have this idea of quality. What is a quality company? And like every, no matter which quant you ask, they'll be like, no, it's this variable, or it's this balance sheet number, or it's this consistency of earnings, or there's so many different ways you can look at it. And I assume in your world, there probably is too. So I wanted to ask you, what do you think when you say you want to own good companies, what do you think a good company is? Like at a high level, how would you define that?
So I would say they are profitable in their existing lines of business. They can deploy the profits at an equal or better rate of return, and they don't have so much debt that they can't manage. Bonus points for not needing to raise external capital to grow. But if their opportunity set is so large that they can't finance it internally, I don't penalize them if that's the reason they're raising external capital, whether equity or debt, et cetera. But that's really what I'm looking for, right? Are they profitable on their existing business? Can they reinvest it well? And have they levered up too much, or can they manage their debt? That, to me, is a quality company.
It's interesting. Like that's not too far to how you do it on the quant side. Like it's certain very. I mean, you look at it in a different way, but the ideas are actually very similar.
Oh, good.
You focus a lot on return on equity. Why do you do that?
So Rob built a model to value companies when he kind of entered the business in the 70s, and it used two inputs. It used return on equity, which at the time was reasonably stable for a given company over time. And he used the rate of inflation, right? So he used the rate of inflation instead of interest rates, because he thought that interest rates were mispriced at the time. And the people that used interest rates, which were below the rate of inflation, came up with a different, often higher value for a company than he did when he used the rate of inflation as the discount rate. So people were recommending, oh, this company is fairly priced based on, let's say, an interest rate of 6%. And he's saying, no, it's too expensive based on an inflation rate of 9. So they were making investments that he was shying away from because they overvalued it because they were using a different base. So, you know, ROE was relatively easy to get a hold of the number. It was relatively stable over time. He used that as a useful proxy for profitability. And then he said, you know, what has Wall Street historically paid for that amount of profitability, right? Have they paid what multiple of book? Was really the analysis that he did. And that formed his model, right? And we've continued to use it because it continued to be helpful.
That idea of using inflation as a discount rate is really interesting to me. And it probably allows you to have some divergent opinions. You know, it's great when you can have an investing, when you can have a divergent opinion from the market and you can be right. And that's something everybody's using interest rates in their models. So that probably allows you to see some companies very, very differently than other people see them.
Interest rates in the 70s were inverted, right? They were negative real interest rates. And by using inflation instead of interest rates, it allowed him to account for that. He said, essentially, negative rates are nonsense. And so what's wrong, it's wrong, is not the interest rate. That's not where I should plant my feet and evaluate everything relative to this. He said, I'm going to plant my feet on inflation and evaluate the value of everything relative to that. So much like physics, right, where everything, you know, motion is all relative. You have to defy one place to be stationary, and all the other motion is relative to that, right? So if you say, well, how fast is the car going? The question is relative to what? If you plant your feet on the ground, the car is going 50 miles an hour. If you plant your feet on the car is stationary, and the world is moving at 50 miles. So you've got to kind of define by default, what is zero? What is ground zero? Where do I plant my feet? And then evaluate everything relative to that. Well, if you plant your feet in the wrong place, and he thought that bonds were mispriced based on inflation because there were negative real rates. He said, I can't plant my feet on bonds because they're off. So I have to plant my feet somewhere else. And he planted them on inflation, and it worked. It gave him lower valuations. It kept him out of overpriced stocks and put him into stocks that did better during that inflationary time frame. Now, when bonds are properly priced relative to inflation, which they were from the 80s until, you know, 2010 or 12, and arguably they're not far off now, then there's less of a difference, right? There's not a whole lot of difference between planting your feet on inflation or planting your feet on interest rates, treasury rates. But sometimes there are. When treasuries get mispriced, basing your valuation on treasury rates leads you astray. That's really his conclusion. And he simply said, okay, I'll use inflation and I'll use it throughout and we'll remain consistent that way.
The next thing on your list was growth. And that's interesting to me because coming out of the zero rate environment, this idea of sustainable growth is probably very important. Like companies that are actually going to be able to sustain their growth into the future. Like, how do you think about that? How do you think about evaluating the growth of a company and if you think it's sustainable into the future?
So I think you have to, and I think it's hard. It is very difficult at the time to decide if somebody's growth spurt or growth collapse is going to hold for the long term or not, right? So for some companies that are product-oriented, right? So for Apple or for Tesla or for somebody like that whose product is unique to a degree, you've got to say, okay, what's the broader market? How fast and how far do I think this product is going to be adopted? Once it's adopted, then what's the normal turnover rate? So, you know, if you go from no smartphones in the world and Apple brings out the first smartphone, then the first question you've got is, okay, well, how many people are going to buy one? And that's a guess, right? And it could be, well, I think everybody over 18 will end up having one. Well, that's a different number from everybody over 12, right? And that's a different number from 50% or whatever. And all of those will be a guess initially, and then you have to start, you know, was my guess close or not very, depending on how the data starts to come in. But then you'll have this huge spike in demand as people that didn't have one go and buy one. But at some point, everybody that wanted one has one. So now the question is, what's the sustainable replacement rate? Right? How often do I want to trade in that old iPhone for the new iPhone? And a little bit, that's going to depend on the person. Some are going to want to be very up to date with the latest development, and they're going to want to trade in every time Apple brings out a new, slightly improved product. And others are going to be like, I use this one until it wears out, or I drop it in the toilet or whatever. Right? But it's going to be less than that adoption rate. And so for all of those things, it's really tough. And we tend to be on the low side of things in most cases. And sometimes that works out, sometimes that doesn't. Right? So when you start talking about, you know, when I started 15 years ago and analysts were talking about electric automobiles, right? The mantra at the time was shared, autonomous, and electric. That was the future of the vehicle fleet, and it was going to happen in a decade. They were all going to be shared, they were all going to be autonomous, and they were all going to be electric. You don't hear that anymore, right? You don't hear much about sharing. In fact, every company that I can find that had a shared fleet kind of a product, whether it was scooters or automobiles, has gone bust. So that didn't happen. So whatever you were guessing about the amount of shares, you know, shared vehicles, all those guesses were wrong and ended up being zero. Autonomous. Yeah, we keep getting that promise every year. It's an annual event. I suspect we'll get there. And for all I know, by the time we do, everybody will be, you know, have completely discounted. Oh, it's never going to happen. And then surprise, it will. You know, but that one's taken longer than anybody's expected. Now, with electric, I would argue that the eventual adoption is still unknown. Right. But I have always been projecting lower adoption rates than many of the analysts that project high adoption rates. You know, if you believe and if the high adoption rates come to fruition, then frankly, you know, the valuation of Tesla is not extreme. If lower rates come to fruition, then it is extreme. And it's all a guess. And some of it really has to do with the mindset of the person making the forecast. Are they kind of a techno-optimist or are they a techno-skeptic? Kind of a thing. That's hard business, and getting that right is difficult, but you have to guess. And then you have to kind of update your guess based on how things are unfolding. But that's also a part of the valuation of a company, right? So when, you know, people say, are you a buyer or a growth investor? I'm like, well, growth is a part of value. How can I not look at the prospects for growth and then try to put a figure on that in terms of what the company is worth? Usually the way I look at it is I'm looking for that growth to be a call option. I'm looking for companies where that potential growth is not priced into the stock. And so if it happens, it's an upside surprise and I will benefit thereby. Because if you say, well, that high adoption rate, that rapid growth is baked into the price, well, now you're kind of in the position where if they disappoint, you're going to pay the penalty, right? So you're setting yourself up for disappointment, not a positive surprise. I'd rather set myself up for that positive surprise. That's kind of how I think about it. And you know, that doesn't always work great in the short term. Okay.
Yeah, what you're talking about is I think one of the core concepts is the most important in investing, which is this idea of expectations versus reality. Mm-hmm. You know, you just because a company's growing huge rates, if the market expects it to grow faster than that, then it's not a great investment. So it's like trying to figure out what the expectations are in the stock price. And, you know, Michael Mobison's work is really good on this. And then, you know, trying to have a divergent opinion and being correct is the challenge of this whole thing.
And I think the idea of optionality is useful, right? And setting yourself up for that kind of a thing, limited downside, you know, much, much higher upside, having some optionality in there that the market does not recognize. I think that's a useful concept to have when you're looking at companies.
How do you think about financial strength? That's something I've thought about a lot too. We had Steve Romick on the podcast, and you know, I've typically thought about financial strength in terms of having a strong balance sheet, but he was making the point to us that, you know, in the current market, he looks at financial strength from the perspective of the quality of the business a lot, in terms of the consistency of the business he's looking at. And he thought a lot of the tech firms, you know, were very financially strong firms, the big tech firms, from that perspective. So how do you think about this idea of financial strength?
I think both are useful. I think, you know, we start with what does the debt load look like? When is it mature? What are they paying on it? And now we also look at what do the cash flows look like? How sustainable do we think they are? And how much does that cover their debt? That sort of thing. But you also have to look at if it's a levered company, what is the asset base? And that really starts, you know, when you're talking banks or insurance companies, what is the asset base? What is it valued at? And what are the possibilities for what the future value of that asset base are? So, you know, if you're, and that's part of what makes banks so tough. You don't know what their loans are, right? So, but if you're buying a regional bank today, you've got to try and figure out what's their exposure to commercial real estate and how confident am I that their $10 per share of book value is really $10 per share of book value in today's commercial real estate environment. But they could realize that for cash if they needed to. Or do I need to discount that by some factor because the market has changed and they haven't priced it yet? So a little bit, it depends on, you know, quality changes based on what the industry and what the structure of the company are. Banking is very different. Insurance is very different when you start looking at those sorts of things. Now, the rest are a little bit easier. But yeah, we always start with what is the actual debt. Now, we also add in their pension expense, right? So for a fairly small subset of U.S. companies, there are significant pension liabilities, then you have to include those as well.
How do you think about management? This is something, like, as quant investors on our side, we don't really think about at all. But when I talk to discretionary managers, you kind of have two different camps. You have one camp that says, I love talking to management. I think I get really great information from that. You have the other camp that says, management's just going to tell me what I want to hear. So really, it doesn't help me at all to talk to management. Like, how do you think about, like, first of all, what do you think a good management team is? But also, how much do you think communicating with management is important to you?
Communicating with management, we'll start with the second one. Communicating with management to us is more important the smaller the company. Larger companies tend to have processes and systems, and so it's difficult for a bad manager to go too far off the rails when you've got a larger company. And it's also, you know, when you've got 6 or 8 or 10 analysts all covering it, you usually find out pretty quickly from one or two of them if something screwy is going on. You've got a lot of attention focused on that company, whereas, you know, small cap or micro cap, they have no attention. Nobody's paying attention. Nobody's analyzing their business, and you need to do more due diligence because nobody else is. I'm not saying you can accept at face value what sell-side analysts bring to the table, but they do bring value to the table. And it's interesting you ask that question, because there are a couple of times where I have allowed my opinion management to influence my decision to buy or not buy the stock. And in none of those cases has it actually helped me make the right decision. Right. So, 15 years ago, when we were looking at Apple, which we ended up buying, we still own today, full disclosure. I looked at Steve Jobs and I said, that guy's horrible. You know, he's just a complete jerk as a manager. I wouldn't want to work for him. His company's going to implode. Turned out not to be the case. All those statements are true. None of them were critical. What was critical is, even though he was horrible and a jerk, he managed to drive his people to produce things that they would not have otherwise produced. And I think you can say the same thing about Elon Musk. I think it has been said, right? He's not a great guy to work for. And, you know, I was looking at Tesla 6 or 8 years ago, whatever, and looking at the high turnover of some very senior people. I'm like, oh my God, how do you run that business if you're turning people over that fast? And yet, his personality is such, and what he demands is such, the people are actually producing far more. They're overachieving in that environment. It's burning them out fast, and he's replacing them, but they still do, right? So, you know, you can't, third example, Google. Google, 3-4 years ago, there were a lot of headlines out there about all the infighting with the different political factions inside of Google. And I'm like, how can you have a culture where this group spends half its day yelling at this group on their shared little message board and create any value for me to share? Why would I want to buy into that dysfunctional culture? And yet, if you had ignored that and bought the stock, you'd have done great, because it was such a powerful business model. It was almost irrelevant what the people did in the short term, because they had such a dominant position in advertising and search.
Right.
So yeah, we look at managements. We like to look at the incentives that management sets up for bonuses. That is one of our key questions. What behavior are you trying to, incent, and how do you do it? So we're much more interested in incentives along the lines of profitability, growth in profitability, growth in market share with profitability, and less in, excited about, we want to grow earnings per share, right? Because that doesn't necessarily make for a better business, that just makes for better earnings per share. So we're looking for what is incentivized by the compensation structure that got in place. We do like to talk to management. Sometimes they are honest and give you unique insights. And sometimes they're salesmen, which frankly is part of the CEO's job, particularly for the startup. He's got to sell his product. He's got to sell his company. And so, I, as the listener, have to put on my skeptic hat and say, okay, how much of this is sales pitch and how much of this is ground truth? And how do I, tease apart the different elements of what the man's telling me? A lot of times we'll ask, what do you think is going to happen in the next 6 months? What do you think is going to happen the next year? What are you trying to achieve? And then we'll come back a year later and compare notes. Okay, how did he do? And what did you learn from the outcome of what you tried to do? Right. So if they're trying to grow the company and they're trying to cut costs, okay, how'd you do? On your own, I've asked you what your score sheet is. What does success look like to you? And then I'm going to compare what you actually did to what you were trying to do. And then that helps me over time. One, do I agree? Is what he's trying to do what I think should be done and useful from an outside investment perspective? And then two, how able is he to deliver on that?
So when you apply your framework, like, what are you finding attractive in the market right now? You mentioned energy, you mentioned gold, you mentioned you own Apple, but I don't think you like a lot of the other big tech names, if I'm correct. Like, what are you finding attractive right now?
So, right now, most of the companies we look at are fairly valued or expensive, right? And I would put most of big tech in that category. Big tech has been very popular. It came off a little bit in late 21 and 22, and then kind of reinflated at the end of 22 and all through 23 as new AI products became available, and that got a lot of people excited. And we still own Apple. We think that's probably a great company for the long term, but they're product land. And right now, all their products are kind of at the end of their growth stage. So in my opinion, Apple is not going to do a lot as a stock until they have a new product out there that gets people excited about and starts to drive revenue growth again. Do I think that's possible? I absolutely think that's possible. Do I know what it is or when it's coming? I certainly do not. We own Microsoft. You know, Microsoft we bought 2016, I think it had a 4% yield at the time. I think it was trading at a 10 PE. And they changed their CEO, and they were generating tons of cash, right? Which to us is like optionality,
right?
Cash, if employed properly, is great. If employed poorly, doesn't do anything for you. And I changed CEOs, jumped onto this idea of the cloud, and that's been their growth engine now for a decade. Right? And it continues to be driving their growth. And now they've added another one, AI. Right. So they're spending a ton of money to roll out this AI capability. It remains, in my mind, a question mark what kind of return they're going to get on that investment. And that was the thought about CEOs. I always like to ask CEOs, what returns are you trying to get on your investments? Or what return did you get on this investment? So, you know, particularly when they buy another company, what are your returns on that 2-3 years later? Right. And it's hysterical, sort of, some of the answers you'll get. Well, we really don't think of it that way. Well, why not? You know, when I put money in a company, I at least can say 3 years later, here's my return. I've made money. I've lost money. Here's the return on my invested capital. You're telling me you don't do that? And if they don't, that makes me kind of, you know, not terribly interested in investing in their company, because they're kind of demonstrating they don't know how to reinvest profit. And that's part of, you know, first they have to generate profit, and then they have to reinvest profit. So if you can do the first and not the second, then please give me your profits. I will reinvest them because you can't. And there are companies like that, right? They tend to be very high payout companies. And, you know, if I find a company that's got 10 or 12% free cash flow and they're paying me a 6% yield and they're buying back 6% of their stock because they got no better options, I'm good with that. I'll take that yield. I'll reinvest it someplace else. But at least the guy's honest, saying, I can't reinvest my profits well. Please do it for me. I will give you the money. Cool. That's great. If I find that same guy and he's buying Learjets and redoing the headquarters building, I'm not excited. He's saying, I'm generating a lot of profits. I'm good at that. And I'm going to make my life better. Well, you go, dude, because you're not working for me. You're working for you.
Yeah, the return on the Learjets is probably not that great, I would assume.
You know, so... And Bob has thought a lot about this, right? A lot of CEOs are good at running the company and generating the profit, and they're not so good at reinvesting that dollar of profit into the next thing. So I'm looking at both aspects, and we're a little bit, you know, I backtracked on you a little bit. I apologize. But I think that's important to think about, right? Because part of what you buy in the company is the current profit stream, but you're also interested in what do they do with that dollar of profit. Can they compound it or not? Because you want the guy that can compound it, right? That's what you got to get going for you. That's what you're looking for. So back to tech. So we own Apple, we own Microsoft, we own a chip company called Microchip, MCHP, and we own Broadcom. And Broadcom did super for us last year because of AI. That's not really what we bought it. We bought it because of their really their investing philosophy. So what they do, as I boil it down, is they buy cash cows, make them better cash cows, and use the profits from those cash cows to go buy the next cash cow. They're not interested in taking any, they buy zero growth companies on purpose. And they're not interested in turning them into growth companies. They're just interested in running them well. And then using the profits from them to go buy the next one. So, you know, I've heard people call them cash compounders. I think that's a great phrase, works for me. And I think that's a logical and potentially profitable way of running those businesses. And I would argue that that's pretty much what Mr. Buffett does, right? He buys profitable companies, not to grow, but to simply take the cash from them to go buy the next really profitable company. And you grow the whole that way. So that's why we own Broadcom. And the fact that some of their businesses became growth businesses, thanks to AI, is optionality, cherry on the top of the cake. Unexpected surprise. It works for me. I'm happy to take it. We do like oil. We think it's a much better industry than it was a decade ago because everybody went through 2020 when oil prices dropped to minus 20. So you weeded out everybody that was too levered. We're past the shale boom, right? When everybody was interested in more and more shale assets and growing their productivity. Now they're interested in profitability. So you have completely shifted the mindset of all the surviving players. Oh, by the way, we picked most of those companies up at really good prices shortly after the 2020 bottom. So we held, Occidental, we held EQT, which is a natural gas producer here in Pennsylvania. We held Schlumberger and we held Transocean. It looks to us like if oil stays between $70 to $90, which is a fairly broad range, that all those companies will be quite profitable and they will make good investment decisions as opposed to poor investment decisions, which is what they were doing 10 years ago. So we're happy with that. We also think that this round, oil is stereotypically boom and bust. Shall boom, shall bust. And now we're ready for the next boom, and it'll take however long to get there. But it looks to me like the activity is more going to be offshore than onshore, right? So because you went from Donald Trump's administration to Mr. Biden's administration, you've had a change in the regulatory environment. So onshore exploration and production is really not rewarded, and it's difficult to jump through all the regulatory hoops. So my guess is that most of the growth in the industry is going to be offshore, which is why, for instance, we own Schlumberger and not Halliburton. That's why we own Transocean. You know, when I first started in the business in 08, 09, 10, the offshore, the deep offshore was the undiscovered territory, and that's where all the growth in oil production was supposed to be coming from. Except then shale was figured out, and it was much cheaper to go explore the shale assets than the deep offshore assets. So the boom actually happened onshore, and offshore dried up and died. You know, Transocean, who was the biggest offshore, almost went bankrupt. So they've been hanging on by their teeth now for the better part of a decade. Well, this time around, I think that's going to reverse. I think most of the activity is going to be offshore, and you're already seeing a lot of that in terms of daily rig rates. So the rig rates keep ticking up. So as Transocean's rigs roll over from the last contract to the next contract, the company's going to get much more profitable, and we think we can benefit by owning them. So that's kind of the story, some of the details around what we're seeing in energy. We're not all that interested in most of the clean energy. It's too expensive. You know, it's very fashionable to invest in clean energy. Fashion usually means the price gets driven up. And so that's less interesting to us. And then gold, I talked about a little bit. Now, we do have exposure, too long exposure to gold. And so far, I would say that's probably the most interesting opportunity, like right now, right today, of anything that I see, because you've had the spot price of gold continue to go up, but the gold miners and the gold royalty companies, the price of their stocks have not moved very much. So even though gold is at an all-time high, the miners and the royalty companies are typically about in the bottom third of their little trading range for the past 3 or 4 years. So all the excitement in gold is really not coming out of what I would argue is probably the domestic U.S. investor. I think it's probably coming from overseas. And sooner or later, My suspicion is the domestic guys will catch a whiff of what's going on and they will pile in because, you know, FOMO kicks in and all the other happy stuff and drives the momentum. But yeah, the most immediate opportunity, I see a big disconnect between the price of gold and the price action of the miners and the royalty companies. And my guess is that the miners move up in tandem as gold continues to rise. I don't think gold's coming back down anytime soon.
This has been great, and I've taken up more of your time than I had scheduled. So I want to shift to our standard closing question. And you answered our other standard closing question the first time you were on. So we've been shifting to a new one. And the question is, when you look to the future, what are you most optimistic about and what are you most worried about? And this can be in the context of investing or in the context of, you know, life or anything, any way you want to take it. But what are you most optimistic about and what are you most worried about as you look to the future?
So when I look at the future, I'm really excited about what technology is doing in healthcare and kind of the resurgence of interest in nuclear power. So I think technology has some great solutions for us to really improve the quality of life. You know, nothing improves your quality of life faster than cheap energy. And we've gotten on the kick of we want it to be carbon free. And without arguing the pros and cons of that approach, we do have a carbon free, cheap solution. And all we need is kind of the political will and the regulatory environment that allows us to roll that out quickly. And we're doing some amazing things in biology. And as we apply all the computing power that we have built over the last 20, 30 years to the problems of biology and of health, I think we're going to see some amazing solutions. They're going to come slowly because it's a heavily regulated environment, because it has to be. If you get it wrong, people die. But they're going to be amazing. And so over a period of time, you're going to see some really exciting things happen. My fear is that for political reasons, we make stupid decisions. And we collectively humans kind of have a pretty long history doing that sort of thing. And usually in the end, physics wins out, common sense wins out, and we make decent decisions, but the path isn't always very straight to get there. Right. So it is my hope that we don't do stupid things out of fear or greed or hate. And that we don't choke off the innovation and the growth and the improvements that are very near at hand for us, right? So, and then, you know, on my dark days, I worry about that. And then on my optimistic days, I'm like, yeah, we'll figure it out. You know, the kids will be fine.
Yeah, we usually do figure it out. So hopefully we will.
Usually, but not always.
Well, this has been great. We really appreciate you coming back on. If people want to find out more about you or your firm, where's the best place to go?
Mollenkamp.com. And we've got a website and you've got phone numbers and email addresses on there. You can learn everything we're doing, learn how to reach out to us, and I would be happy to talk to you. Whether it's about investing or you just want to grab a beer and shoot the shit, happy to do it.
Well, thank you, Jeff. This is great. I really appreciate you coming back on.
Thanks, Jeff. It's been a pleasure.
This is Justin again. Thanks so much for tuning into this episode of Excess Returns. You can follow Jack on Twitter at @practicalquant and follow me on Twitter at @JJCarboneau. If you found this discussion interesting and valuable, please subscribe in either iTunes or on YouTube or leave a review or a comment. We appreciate it.
Justin Carboneau and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.